Excuse me, this call is now being recorded.
Okay, thank you. Could somebody do a roll call for us, please?
Absolutely, Michele. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone. Happy New Year to everyone on our first RRTP call of the year, Tuesday the 5th of January. On today's call, we have Michele Nalon, Mike O'Connor, Barbara Steele, Kevin Erdman, Michael Collins, James Bladel, Barry Cobb, Chris Chaplow. From staff, we have David Gieser, Olaf Nordling, Marika Konings, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White. Anil George will be a few minutes late. No apologies. And if I could just remind everyone to state the name before speaking. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. So good afternoon, everybody. And good morning for those of you in, who are far, far, far away over that side. I don't think there's anybody in the evening time zone, is there? Unless, or is somebody going to correct me now and make me look like an idiot? Did you all get the agenda for today's meeting?
Yep, yep.
Okay, anybody not get the agenda? No, okay, fine. Right, so, right, where are we? Okay, so the ICANN compliance team, do we have anybody from ICANN compliance on the call?
We do. It's Dave Gieser here.
David, have you had three or four coffees already or not?
I'm actually starting my first coffee right now, but I think I'll be awake enough to get through this morning's meeting here.
So it must be, what, about 4 o'clock in the morning your time or something silly?
No, actually, it's not that bad. It's 7 a.m. here in L.A.
Oh, okay, then forget it. You're not going to get any sympathy from me.
I usually never do.
Very true. If nobody has any other business they want to deal with, I think we'll pass over to David for an update from compliance.
Mm-hmm, thank you. Yeah, this is Dave Gieser from ICANN's compliance group. And what I wanted to do this morning here in LA is give you a brief update on the research work that we're doing in response to the request that we received from the working group. And you may recall from the last call, I mentioned that our team was going to essentially investigate and review 5 months' worth of consumer complaint data, starting with July of 2009 through November of 2009. And our team has reviewed 4 of the 5 months, and they're actually finishing the 5th month this week. And so on our next call, I'll have the our final findings and report. But what I can share with you today is some preliminary observations and some preliminary findings, you know, as we've examined, 4 months' worth of complaint data. And I think you'll find some of this information interesting. The way that we're analyzing the data, we're building, unfortunately, an Excel spreadsheet. That's the tool we have to use at the moment. And we're capturing the name of the registrar. We're capturing the name of the person who filed the complaint. We're also identifying the complaint ticket number, the date we received the complaint, and the date that the registrar received the complaint, the date that the registrar responded. And then as you move across this Excel spreadsheet, we're listing the various categories concerning the nature of the complaint. And what we've found so far is that there are essentially 5 categories that seem to be reoccurring. The first category is failure to provide an authorization code. The second category is that the registrant just simply doesn't understand the transfer process. The third category is a wrongful denial of transfer by the registrar. Fourth category is failure to unlock the domain by the registrar. And the fifth category are, let's say, a collection of reseller issues that impact the transfer process. And based on 4 months' worth of analysis, it looks like our top 3 categories at the moment, and I'll give them to you in order, is first, there's about 25% of the complaints falling into the failure to provide the authorization info code. The second category, about 24%, is reseller-related issues. And our third category at the moment is the failure to unlock the domain, which is right around 15 to 16% of the complaints. So between those 3 categories, you know, we're starting to see a pattern emerge here. It's interesting that right now only about 10% of registrants, you know, tell us that they don't really understand the transfer process, and only about, I'd say about 4% right now tell us that they've experienced a wrongful denial of transfer by the registrar. And then as you move past those five categories, then you start to trail out into some smaller categories that we're collecting data on. But again, you know, I don't have anything final to tell you other than those categories represent, you know, WHOIS issues, some privacy proxy issues, domain has been hijacked or stolen, and then there are some ownership issues as well. And so in those instances, the percentages right now are all in the single digits. So by the time we gather again for our next call, we'll have our analysis completed on November. That'll represent essentially 5 months worth of current data, and I don't suspect that this pattern will change much, quite frankly. And so, hopefully, from this data and from the Excel spreadsheet that I send to you, you know, prior to the next meeting, that will help the working group determine specifically how to address these top three, you know, potentially top five categories of complaints for, you know, for purposes of making some policy recommendations going forward.
David, just one question, which Barry's just put on the chat there. What volume, I mean, as in terms of how many complaints are you looking at? I mean, how many, are we talking about 100 complaints, 1,000 complaints, 10,000 complaints?
Sure. For the entire five-month period, we're looking at 1,330 complaints, and so we're averaging somewhere between 200 to 250 complaints per month.
Okay, thank you. What's the other question? So just to summarize, the top three you had in no particular order were getting EPP code keys, getting domains unlocked, and issues related in some respect to resellers.
Mm-hmm, correct. Yeah, and actually the particular order, Michaela, is getting the EPP code seems to be the number one complaint. Resellers appear to be the number two complaint, and failure to unlock the domain is the third highest number of complaints.
Okay, and another, just one other question, just to satisfy my own personal curiosity. Are you seeing a spread across registrars, or are you seeing some registrars reoccurring constantly? I mean, is it like a kind of spread across all, or just focused on one or two?
You know, it's interesting. It really is a spread across registrars. Obviously, some of the larger registrars have more complaints by volume, but when you look across, you know, the 1,330 data files, it really is a spread across large, medium, and small registrars globally.
Michael Collins has a question.
Yes, David. Without a detailed analysis, can you elaborate a little bit on the kinds of issues that are involved with reseller? What kind of problems are identified as just reseller problems?
I can tell you that, you know, from our early analysis, it looks like it's largely a communication problem that the registrant is having with the reseller, as the reseller attempts to facilitate, the transfer request, in connection with providing service to the reseller's customers. So I think, at least at the early outset here, it looks like it's mostly a variety of communication challenges or problems. I also think that, you know, it's interesting when you look at the EPP issues here. It seems like it's more a question of, you know, not following the process, and so I do think that there's some level of confusion around how the two particular forms are supposed to be used, who's responsible to, you know, to actually secure the information in the form that's required.
Which particular forms are you referring to? Sorry.
Yep. Oh, okay. let me go back here and I'll pull up my notes.
Sorry, it's just because it's probably beautifully clear to you, but for some people on the call, it may not be clear what exactly you're talking about.
Yeah, there's a particular form that the gaining registrar has to submit to the to essentially the losing registrar in the transfer process. And then there's another form that the registrar of record, or the losing registrar, can submit to the its customer for purposes of confirming the information surrounding the transfer request. And it does appear that at times there is some confusion about how those forms are supposed to be used in the process, even though the policy attempts to clearly state who's responsible to initiate the use of the forms. It doesn't appear that those forms are always used, consistent with the requirements stated in the policy. So that could be simply just an information and education issue that, registrars may need to address either with their employees or may need to address with their customers, as we move forward with our work here.
So that's an issue on the registrar side, is what you're saying?
Correct.
Okay, fine. Now, just taking questions in order, which you seem to be appearing, Chris and then Mikey, and just acting as voice for Barry. Barry, we just wanted a confirmation that all these complaints were coming via the Internic channel website form thing.
Mm-hmm,
is
correct.
That correct, David?
That's correct.
Okay. So Chris and then Mikey.
Right, thank you. Chris speaking. Yeah, this is very interesting indeed, and it falls very much within the sort of experiences that we have. Now, we're obviously in the world of small businesses. We do website design for various clients. And a very typical scenario for us, so we're not really talking of hijacking, but it's quite clearly when a client says, I want to move my domain or move my hosting to another supplier, my web designer will contact you, and then the web designer doesn't, or eventually the web designer does, and we provide a key, and then nothing happens. And then we provide a key again, and nothing happens, and everybody goes around in circles, and then the client, the registrant, will come back and say, why has nothing happened? And I think really it's all down to education and people putting in a little bit of effort to follow the procedures. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Mikey?
Thanks, Michele. This is Mikey. David, two questions for you. The first question is, do you see any trending in the data? Is one of these increasing and others decreasing over time, or is it too short a period to be able to draw anything on that? And then I've got another question for you after that.
Sure. I think 5 months is probably too short a period, Mikey, to answer that question, correctly. I think after we do some additional work beyond these first 5 months, I may be able to give you better clarity around trends. But again, just from looking at 4 months of the data and now going into the fifth month, it does seem that the level of complaints are continuing to increase, but not at a dramatic level. And again, it seems that the number of complaints as they increase, seem to fall into these three categories more often than not, and that leads me to believe that that we need to focus in those three particular areas and determine what can be done through the policy process to improve communication, education, and ultimately improve and maybe find a way to sort of fast track the process for the benefit of registrants.
Okay, thanks, David. Now, the second question is about forms and your use of that term. I'm assuming, and Michele and James and others can probably jump in and clarify this, that these forms are electronic, yes? Or are these actual paper forms?
They can be electronic, they can be paper.
That's correct.
It's the policy refers to that he's referring to is the what the hell they called it, the FOA or whatever the hell it's called.
Mm-hmm,
sorry,
that's right, FOA.
Acronym hell. Sorry, I'm out of practice with all the acronyms. I was talking to normal human beings over Christmas. People who use full sentences and whatever.
Pick. Some people are just never satisfied.
Yeah, I know. Most people will be using electronic, but they can be hard copy, they can be faxes.
Okay, so then I've got a follow-up thought, which is that in a way, maybe what we're looking at to a certain extent is a scaling problem, not unlike what we're looking at the zone file level, where as the number of registrars increases...
Why would that be a scaling problem?
Well, because if the forms are... Is there a clearinghouse for forms where a registrar goes to a single place with
the forms
FOA?
Are standard. The forms are standard. They're not... We cannot edit any of the text in them.
Right.
Where
do they reside? Are they in a central repository or are they pairwise? Because if they're pairwise, then this is a scaling problem. Well, in other words, if there's a registrar to registrar pairwise relationship here, and the number of registrars increases and the number of pairs thus increases, then as the total number of registrars expands, the number of pairwise relationships expands geometrically, and that's a scaling problem. So I'm just curious about the process. I just don't know anything about it.
Would one of my fellow registrars like to jump in?
No, they don't. They don't like you.
Thanks, guys.
This is James. I'll jump on that hand grenade.
Thank you, James.
No, I think I get what you're saying, Mikey. In that, in the exchange of forms is not going from a registrar to a central clearinghouse to the other affected registrar. It is, in fact, a registrar to registrar link. However, I don't think that that's a scaling process or a problem so long as each registrar is abiding by the policy and has a system and procedures to both generate and accept those different types of authorization. The problem we get into, and we're having this now with a couple of different smaller registrars, is when there's either some sort of a breakdown in that chain of information where we cannot, in a thin registry particularly, we cannot locate any of the who is information for a customer who's trying to move a name. And that becomes an issue. Of course, the policy takes into account the idea that the losing registrar doesn't respond at all. And in most cases, I think that that's after the 5 days, that just moves over. But I think that the problem we're seeing right now is just this breakdown in that chain of information. And as long as everyone complies with the policy, I think it works, and it's not really a scaling process. But I understand your concern that there is no centralized clearinghouse of this information, and I'll let Paul and Michele jump in with their experience as well.
Paul? Okay, thanks, Michele. James, fully concur with everything James said. It's not an issue of scale, but definitely concur with the problem. We have registrars who, for whatever reason, are not publishing the WHOIS information, trying to run them down to contact them to assist the customer with their transfer. That's a problem. That is an issue, a real-world one. Ultimately, it's a ICANN compliance enforcement issue, in my view, and we do take it up with them when we run into these problematic registrars. But the overall process is not a scaling concern.
This is Mikey again. Is the process largely done by email? Are the
yes.
forms largely email forms?
It's email and EPP, which EPP may not be email. It could be over HTTP.
Right.
Yeah.
But electronic. So electronic.
It's electronic, yes.
Okay.
Which protocols doesn't, it's a different matter.
And they're largely standardized forms so they can be automated and all that good stuff. So we're not dealing with that issue, correct?
They're standardized.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Unless of course they're not compliant with the policies.
Which I think we're going to find evidence of as we do more research here, but I can tell you from the audit work we've done, and from the audit work that we're actually planning to do next year in connection with our first
IRTP audit, we anticipate we're going to find an interesting level of noncompliance among, you know, certain registrars, again, who just simply haven't made the capital investment necessary either in the systems, technology, or people in order to have the processes in place to facilitate a smooth, quick, and efficient transfer of domain names.
I put myself in the queue, so I'm going to actually abuse that slightly now, if you don't mind. Just echoing what both James and Paul have been saying, at the moment, due to the kind of thing that we're doing, we're dealing with a lot of inbound transfers as opposed to outbound transfers. And the biggest problem we've had has been in relation to Whois format, because the format that the Whois is published in varies considerably between registrars. And while you can probably code your software to deal with the biggest registrars, it becomes more problematic when you're dealing with smaller ones, because you wouldn't be dealing with them as often as anything else. So I'm going to ask a horrible question of ICANN compliance. Does ICANN compliance plan at any point to offer some kind of guidance on best practice for Whois format to registrars?
We haven't planned an advisory in that respect, but you're not the first person to ask the question, and so I do think that there's merit in ICANN taking some position around a Whois format that, from our collective experience, suggests is more useful and more appropriate, and quite frankly, a better way to organize that data. And so I've asked several folks inside of our organization to look into that and comment on what they think would be the best demonstrated example of an organization that has a particularly strong and useful organization around Whois records. And I'll have that information for you on the next call, Michaeli, so that you can share that with the group and then determine at that point what the working group wants to do, with respect to, perhaps a policy guideline or, initiative in that area.
Okay, thank you. James, do you want to jump back in again?
Yeah, just quickly wanted to point out that this is just one of the operational challenges that we encounter with thin registries that we were discussing in IRTPA. Whois formatting is probably a non-issue in thick registries. And neither is chasing down the necessary Whois information from the losing or the registrar of record. I know there's a couple of initiatives going around right now, and I think one of them is in the, is it called the high security option, or what is the name of the week for the for that initiative?
Security TLD advisory.
And I think that it has some guidance in there as well. And I think that while that has questionable merit from a security perspective, it certainly comes into play in an operational context.
Okay. I've got myself in the queue because I had a couple of other questions for our friend from ICANN compliance. I mean, it's great to get that we're getting some of this information back from compliance, and I think your team should be commended for doing this. The question I would have is, do you plan to start tracking and categorizing the complaints moving forward? In other words, so that, say, in 6 months or 6 months or 12 months' time, if another working group had a query about complaints, that you wouldn't have to go off and hurt small animals to get the data, that you'd actually be doing it on a day-to-day basis?
We're definitely going to continue collecting and analyzing the data, month after month here with regard to IRTP issues. But as far as other consumer complaint issues are concerned, we really need to build or to purchase an automation tool that would allow us to segregate the data quickly and do the kind of analysis on the data that unfortunately we've had to do here manually, you know, essentially using an Excel spreadsheet and two employees to go through, you know, over 1,000 records, read those records, and then capture the relevant information from those records in this spreadsheet that's almost completed. So there is a plan here, and it is a two-step plan. You know, continue to work with IRTP, and then put in a budget request for the coming fiscal year to make or buy the software we need to automate this process.
Okay. Another question I had is that, okay, based on some of the data that you have got with regards to issues that you perceive as lying with the registrars, how does compliance intend to communicate that to the registrars?
Well, I think what we were hoping to do was to either use the particular working group channel that we're all currently involved in as one communication tool. Secondly, we are developing our audit plan right now for the fiscal year 2011 IRTP audit, and so we're going to be sharing that information with registrars and with the general public in Nairobi, because we will have a draft document that'll be out for circulation and comment. And then finally, I think we'll reach out and determine if there's a small subset of registrars that might be interested in working together either on an advisory or working together on some sort of best practices set of guidelines that could be useful to not just registrars, but more importantly, I think, useful to registrants going forward.
Okay, and I think I had one other question. This is something that's simply because it's just to satisfy my own curiosity, as I'm not sure of the answer. At the moment when you receive a complaint, how anonymous is the complaint?
It's interesting. Most people do give us enough information to identify them. So although there is a percentage of folks who just simply, don't disclose their identity when they file a complaint, but I'd say in 80% of the cases we've got information on the complainant, and that information is held in confidence by ICANN.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else have any questions?
Michele, it's Paul. Can I just ask a quick one?
Sure.
Quick call of you, question, David. When you said you'll be doing the IRTP audit, I didn't catch, is that in this calendar year or is that planned for next year?
ICANN's fiscal year.
I know, that's why I'm asking. Is it this calendar year or next year?
It'll be this calendar year, but it'll be the latter part of this calendar year, sometime between July and December.
Perfect. Thank you.
Chris has his hand up.
Yeah, Chris here. I'm just thinking about this largest category, failure to provide the authorization code. Are we talking here then about the registrar failing to provide the authorization code? Or are we talking about when the domain's been transferred from one party to another, the selling or losing registrant is not providing the code? Does that question make sense?
I think it does. I'd like to hear some of the experiences that James and Michele and others have had. But I think again, the system is designed to operate in an automated fashion, and so if when the system is working correctly between two registrars, that information should be provided seamlessly, through an electronic exchange of emails. But again, James, in your experience, where have you seen more of the breakdowns in terms of not getting the EPP code?
Well, this is James. If I'm understanding the question correctly, it's where the failure to provide the authorization code. I think most commonly it is that the registrar of record, either through their interface or their domain management website that they provide to their registrants, doesn't offer that feature, or has several delays, or it's not clear to the user how to request or retrieve the authorization code, and when that request is finally made, you know, the authorization code is delivered via email, and that email number comes. So I'm trying to, with one sentence, trying to draw a lasso around all of the possible scenarios there, but I think that's the most common one, is getting the auth info code from the registrar of records.
Okay.
I mean, just from our experience, it would be pretty similar, but it getting getting, in some cases, getting an EPP code is the problem. In other cases, getting a correct EPP code is the problem. Because they'll give an EPP code, but it's not the right one. Michael Collins has his hand up.
Well, it's amusing. It seems to be the problem I'm having exactly myself. I'm in the process of trying to transfer a domain name from registrars that are apparently cooperating, but the EPP code that I am inputting keeps getting denied. And I think maybe it's a copy and paste problem. Maybe it's picking up characters I can't see. I don't know. But there is a problem somewhere.
Well, just the current registrar can generate a new EPP code.
Yeah, they are, and they send it to me, and I copy and paste it into the form at the gaining registrar, and I keep getting a failure notice due to improper code.
Well, that's because you're obviously not dealing with Black Knight GoDaddy or Network Solutions. So that's the problem.
There you go.
Well, I won't comment.
Okay,
one of the parties
okay, so
is GoDaddy, but we'll see. Okay.
Uh-oh.
Anybody else? Any other comments? Barry's made a comment on the chat, just mentioning that it's a bit of a, well, how do I rephrase this? It's a sticker to registrants, but they've already paid for the transfer at the gaining registrar, just as a comment. Okay. Michael, do you still have your hand up, or is that from before?
No, that's from before. Sorry.
Okay. Any other queries or questions for David, as we have him, and he can't run away? Well, he can try. No? Okay, thank you, David. So
you're welcome.
David,
Kelly, sorry, just one.
Yep,
one quick question. Should we continue to direct these types of, challenges to ICANN compliance, David, when we encounter them, or?
You should. You should use the... the actual complaint processes that we've set up, email compliance directly at our compliance email box, and then you can always contact me directly if you haven't received a response or if it's time sensitive and it needs immediate action. You can contact me or any member of our team, and we'll certainly get on it right away. But I think it is appropriate to make sure that you're continuing to bring that information to our attention so that when we're ready to launch this audit in the next fiscal year, that we'll be in the best position possible to do so in a meaningful and constructive way that will really add some value here for the registrar stakeholder community as well as others.
Just one question, David, on that with regards to registrars reporting to you. Do you differentiate between reports from accredited registrars from those from the public?
We do have a way to separate that in our intake complaint system, but basically we generally treat every complaint the same. And so, again, if there's a sense of urgency around a particular complaint, then that needs to be pointed out to us in the when the complaint is filed. And if for some reason, you haven't received a response, from ICANN, feel free to go beyond the standard complaint process and reach out to the compliance team.
Okay. All right, thank you. Any other questions for David? No? Okay, then. Now, I believe we have here the public comment period and analysis grade. Marika, I think, was dealing with that.
Yes, this is Marika. So what you see on the screen is an updated version of the public comment review grid, which basically includes the notes from our previous call. And we basically left off on page 3, almost at the bottom. So I would propose that we just continue there. Do you agree?
Perfect. Yep.
So this comment basically states it's a proposal for inclusion of specific language in Chapter 3 of the IRTP to ensure that the domain is unlocked within 5 days following a request by a registrant. This is in relation to Issue D, whether standards or best practices should be implemented regarding use of registrar lock status.
Okay, any queries, questions, anybody? No? Okay, please continue.
Well, I guess the question would be there, is that something that people would think would be worth considering or not at all? Or people want to think about it?
Hi, this is Barbara. From my perspective, I know that there are a lot of parameters as far as timing of when various pieces of information should be provided. And so from this perspective, I don't think it would hurt to put a parameter of what the expected turnaround time would be for unlocking a domain name. I mean, I know there's language that says that, you know, that it should be done within reason and that type of thing. But I think that to have a timing parameter, I think it only helps to set expectations.
This is Mikey. That was exactly what I was going to say as well. So I'd support that.
I thought there was something about a certain number of days in the existing policy, or am I misremembering things?
It's not specific.
It says failure by the registrar record to respond within 5 calendar days. Oh, that's for registry. David?
No, I think it's, at the moment, I think it's just the response is required within a reasonable period of time. But what's reasonable differs among, you know, among people, and to Barbara's point, it varies under the circumstances. So if you want clarity on that point, I would agree, set a fixed amount of time in which you expect the activity to occur, and then if it doesn't, there ought to be a consequence for failure, you know, to unlock the domain.
Okay. I think actually I just realized what I was referring to. Okay, this is a bit of a non, it doesn't make much sense. The current policy specifically states that the registrar must provide the EPP code within 5 days, but the domain could still be locked if you were to interpret the policy loosely, as it were.
Mm-hmm, correct.
Okay. Okay. Fair enough. Does anybody have an issue with the concept of adding some language into the policy about ensuring that the domain is unlocked as well within the 5-day period? Barbara likes the idea, obviously. She adores it. Okay, Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, just a question for the group or something to point out. We've, in working with clients trying to help them with a transfer in request, they've been told that some registrars have an automated means to relock a name. In other words, the registrant can unlock the name, prepare for the transfer, but if it's not executed in a very tight window, the losing registrar software automatically relocks the name. So we might want to consider that situation because it's not extremely uncommon, in fact. And you know, if you're talking about a 5-day period, I think that in the cases that we've tried to help customers through, 5 days is probably more than enough time for those losing registrar software to automatically relock the name. So by the time the customer comes back to execute the transfer, the name's back in lock and it fails and causes a lot of frustration and all the rest. So I'm not sure exactly what the solution is here, but we do have a situation that exists in the marketplace, and it's not an outlier case. There are this happens fairly frequently.
James?
Yeah, I just wanted to echo a lot of what Paul said about the automatic locking and unlocking. Of course, I think that on the surface the response would be that the registrar locks and unlocks the name only upon explicit instructions of the registrar. But then we really should take a look at what that means from a security perspective. It would certainly make transfers more convenient, but it also makes domains much more vulnerable to hijacking and other bad things. So I think that it is reasonable to expect that domains, when a registrant submits an unlock command, that the domain will happen in a reasonable amount of time, and that the domain will remain unlocked for, I would say, a reasonable amount of time. It's difficult to pin down on specific dates, but I think that we need to be mindful again that when a domain is in an unlocked state, it's somewhat fair game for bad actors, and so there's a reason for those locks as well.
Just before I'll throw my thing in, as we're kind of doing the round of the registrars. I mean, the way we have it set up is that by default all the domains are locked for the security reasons. Because if we left them open, I'd hate to think what would happen. So I'd agree with what James is saying about the security aspect. Just leaving them randomly open and unlocked all the time probably wouldn't be such a good idea. Mikey, you were next.
This is Mikey, and I would agree with what all three of you are saying. I think that in a way what we're up against here is a time interval that reflects an ancient era. Back in the old days when we did these things by email and humans looked at them, and that in fact what we want to do is, I would agree that we should specify what a reasonable amount of time is, both for the time to unlock and also the amount of time, perhaps the minimum amount of time, that the domain remains unlocked. But I'm not sure that 5 days is correct. I mean, that's part of the reason I was asking all that operational stuff, because if everybody was using an automated system, then these intervals should be more on the order of hours rather than days. And so maybe
just Mikey, just there's one problem with that.
Yeah.
If I unlock a domain now, if I request the unlock of a domain from registrar registrar B, doesn't matter who the registrar is,
yeah.
And if their system has queues that and doesn't and unlocks it, let's say for argument's sake, within half an hour the domain is unlocked. So it might not be instant, okay? And if it then automatically relocks within, say, a couple of hours, then I've got a very short window of time to get the domain transfer order into the new system and for the new registrar to send that request through. Because
yeah.
Bear in mind that their system might have queuing, etc., etc., etc. So just bear that in mind.
No, I get that. That's part of the reason why I'm always intrigued with clearinghouses. Because one way to avoid a lot of these troubles is by, rather than all of these pairwise relationships with different systems between different registrars, have every registrar pointing at a single system once and letting the clearinghouse handle some of the timing issues. And so I think that we're all in agreement that a minimum time should be specified for, taking some of the reasonable length of time language out of the policy and inserting specific intervals. But I think there's actually quite a tasty analysis to be done around how how to really accomplish that from an operational standpoint. That's probably almost another PDP when you get down to it. Because, you know, stepping back from this conversation and listening to it, this is quite a clunky system that we've got going here to transfer what are now quite important domains for people. That, you know, it's just like it needs to be redesigned, that's all. It looks like a system redesign kind of project to me.
Chris?
Yeah, you know, thinking about it, what Paul's saying is probably right. The problem is probably more the relocking of the domain than the delay in unlocking for the first time. And probably because of these difficulties, the original drafters of the IRTP probably went away from putting time to it and just went reasonable. And I suppose that's a little bit of a cop-out, isn't it, really? And now that things have moved on and time has elapsed and we all could know really what's happening, I think we probably should address this and put some suggestions in for times, both to unlock and to lock again.
James?
Hi, I just had a quick question relative to the history behind the lock and unlock function. Certainly, it seems like it's available as a deterrent to domains going someplace where they're not supposed to, but it seems like it's not completely within control of the registrant, and I mean the registrar lock and unlock as opposed to the registry lock and unlock. If it's not completely in control for the registrar and things are happening you know, without their explicit instruction, then I'm trying to understand exactly what the purpose of this function is then, as it differs from other types of lock that the registrar can put at the registry. So maybe some of the folks who've been around for the older development of the transfer process can help me understand that, or is it obsolete? Do we need something? Do we need to call it something else and change it, change the way it operates, or are we really talking about a transfer active campaign or a feature where we can set something to be transfer active that expires within a certain period of time, or you know, what's the purpose of the lock now?
Chris, you have your hand up. Okay. Barbara, would you like to make any comment about this?
I really don't have anything to add to it. Sorry.
Okay.
This is James. I wanted to draw a distinction between the type of locks that occur at the registry versus the type of locks that registrars put on themselves.
Okay. Mikey?
This is Mikey. I think that James is right on the button with that question. I think that sometimes what happens is systems and processes are in need of change, and the kinds of questions that James is asking is exactly the right one. You know, why is this process here? What function does it fulfill? And that asking that question with an eye towards the possibility that technology and circumstances has changed in the intervening, what probably was 7 or 8 years at least, can lead to a very productive discussion about how to improve the process overall. So the fact that we can't answer that question with the folks on the call, I think, should not be construed to mean that it's not an interesting question. I think it's probably one of the most interesting questions that we can raise going forward.
So does anybody have any recollections as to how this all happened? take the deathly silence as a no. Okay. Marika or David?
Yes.
Since you work for ICANN and probably can find these things out for those of us who don't, would it be possible to find out some more about how these processes came into being in the first place for us? As in, where, what the thinking was behind them?
I'll do my best.
I mean,
just specifically related to the locking of the mains.
Yeah, it's to do, if you were listening to what both James and Mikey were asking about. James might be able to clarify. James?
Yes, and I can help with that if you want to contact me after the call. But basically the question is, what was this feature or this function attempting to mitigate, and is it still valid, or is it being used in a way that wasn't originally intended, and we need to clarify the new uses of the lock feature?
This is Mikey. I'll help with that too, Marika.
Okay.
Yep. Marika, this is Dave. you and I may want to reach out to Dan Halloran, who you know, is a pretty good source of historical information, as one, you know, one contact person inside of ICANN who can help with this.
Right. I'll do so.
I mean, it would be interesting to see where these things came from, rather than just kind of going, oh, that's the way it's been for years type thing. Okay.
And this is Marika. It might be worth as well in checking with some of the people that were involved in writing this initial policy. I can look back as well at the working group member list.
Exactly.
That are still involved. I don't know, for example, maybe Tim was involved at the time as well in that discussion, so maybe he has some recollection as well of you know, how that came into being.
Mikey?
And this is Mikey. As long as we're on the take a look into the past and perhaps revise for the future discussion, I thought I'd throw another grenade out there, and that is, how's about we have a similar conversation about thin registries? Since a lot of this trouble is due to the fact that the largest registry is thin, and if we could get it converted to thick, we could have a lot smoother processes going on. I don't know if you want to tick that one on or not, but that's sort of the elephant that's been in the room for me for quite a while.
I've got a link about elephants in rooms that I'll share with you later, Mikey. Does anybody have any comments on that?
Cowards. You're all cowards.
Yeah, I think this is James, and just what we said before, that it is an operational challenge to get some of the other of our colleagues in the registrar community to cough up the information that we need that is in a thick registry would be sent to us in milliseconds. So I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, and I'll echo James. I mean, and because I'm young and naive, I'll go so far as to say I'd love it. But that's just me personally. And I now expect to receive death threats via email from some registrars.
Is it really this is Mikey again, sorry. But is it really registrars that are cranky, or is it simply the operational hassle of converting the registry? Barbara, where's your gang at on this? Would they be willing to even consider a PDP to take a look at switching .com and .net over to thick registries?
Well, I know this conversation has been had on several fronts, and it, you know, from our perspective, you know, we obviously have always been a thin registry, and a lot of that goes back to the history of when we were both the registry and the registrar, and people did not want us to have the registrant data. At this point, I can say that there are no plans to convert com and or net to a thick registry.
But again, this is Mikey again. Again, that's one of those assumptions that's changed sort of situations where now that you're not the registry and the registrar, the issue is moot. And, you know, I can understand how you wouldn't want to take that on as a charitable act all on your own without consensus across the whole community. But would there at least be a willingness to discuss it? I think certainly not in this PDP, but in some forum, because maybe what we could do is recommend the launch of that conversation and then let the orderly, stately process unfold. Or would you guys just throw your bodies on the tracks and say, absolutely no way?
Yeah, obviously I can't say, you know, what people would do here because that's, you know, kind of out of my bailiwick. But I can obviously talk to the engineering team, the business team, to see if I can, you know, get a formal position on where we would be with that.
I think it's useful, that's Mikey again, too. I think it's useful to have that conversation informally before we get too formal, partly because we could avoid a train wreck, but partly because maybe there's an opportunity here for everybody if we could figure out a way to get that conversation started in a positive light.
Olo?
Oh, just for the record, and as you, well, I guess all of you know that for the new GTLD applicant guidebook, there was a recent inclusion in that one, in version 3, that to have compulsory tick whois for new GTLD registries. So, well, on popular demand, one could say, but a rather insistence from quite a few communities that we should have it like that. So, well, just as a memento.
Okay. Anil George?
Hello. I wanted to commend Mikey because I think the thick registry issue seems to be something that's worth discussing as a practical way of addressing this hijacking issue. And I think if there is a feeling among the registrars about why that shouldn't be one possible course of action, I think it would be helpful to have more specific information about why that would be burdensome from an operational standpoint to overcome, you know, an issue that's as important as hijacking.
This is Barbara. Could I interject here just really quick? I know that in some of the previous conversations that we've had, there has been concern over the availability of, you know, admin contact information and registrant contact information, registrant contact information and admin contact information, and the fact that, you know, the largest registry does tend to be a thin registry. That information is not publicly available, at least the registrant information, which I know in the previous conversations we've had could very well assist in preventing hijackings because the information is not so readily available. And would we see more hijackings if that information were available publicly?
James?
Yeah, real quickly, I just wanted to point out that a lot of the challenges that we encounter with thin registries can be addressed if we have compliance with uniform compliance with the IRTP and you know, a rapid intervention on the part of ICANN when we discover that a registrar is not compliant. So I think that, you know, that it is a bump in the road, but it's not necessarily a roadblock. So we've learned to work with the thin registries.
Just my two cents on the thin registries. If the whois was standardly formatted in a standard manner, across all registrars. In other words, we wouldn't have as much problems with transfers. Then, if you know, the thin registry issue wouldn't be as much of an issue. But the other thing as well is that, unless I misunderstood things, isn't the provider of .com and .net under a contract with ICANN?
Yes.
And that contract is not forever and ever and ever?
Well, this is Dave. Yes, in a manner of speaking, that's true. But the contract is up for review and renewal. That's correct.
Well, I mean, the thing is that if I can field, and I'm sorry, Barbara, please don't take this personally. If I can field that, you know, that the registries should all be using the same model, is it possible for ICANN to mandate that be included in a revision to the contract?
This is Dave. It's a very interesting thought, and I think it's an interesting question to explore in terms of, you know, ICANN's, you know, policy setting in that regard. And you know, it's certainly something Marika and I can, you know, raise with others inside of ICANN to determine if there's traction around, you know, around that suggestion.
Mikey, and then Anil.
Thanks, Michele. This is Mikey. That's why I was thinking that it's probably a good idea for us to sort of take everybody's temperature very carefully, and then if there's a reasonable level of comfort with the idea, I think what we ought to do is launch a separate, I'm not sure what it is, whether it's a policy discussion or a non-policy discussion around this issue, because it seems to me that, you know, there's the possibility that we could poison the well if we're not careful with the way we start this conversation. And at the same time, if we started it well, we could build a lot of initial agreement and support. So I'd be careful about saber-rattling at this stage of the game and encourage thoughtful, careful conversations leading up to perhaps a fairly innocuous recommendation from us that simply says that a lot of operational issues might be resolved, and encouraging a conversation about that. You know, several questions come to mind. Who's going to pay? How long is it going to take? You know, what's the... Certainly, if I were in VeriSign's shoes and someone said, you get to upgrade to a thick registry and you don't get any compensation from anybody to do it, I would probably be less than enthusiastic about that idea. At the same time, I think that there are lots of cost justifications and benefits that could be woven into this conversation, benefits mostly to registrars and registrants that could be used to offset the costs that the registry might incur. And that's, talk about scope creep, that's way outside the scope of this conversation, but I think if we could test the waters a little bit and then formulate a recommendation based on what we learn.
Mikey, if you just look in the chat there, you'll see that Paul has posted a link to some stuff.
I was part of that group. I'm actually echoing something that I was part of before. But I think that what I'm suggesting now is that we take that recommendation a notch further. And put it in as a recommendation for some sort of formal process. So, there you go.
Okay. Marika, how are we doing for time?
We're actually 7 past the hour. So it's a question whether people are available to continue a little bit more, or whether we should wrap up and continue the discussion next week, as we agreed to switch to weekly conference calls from now on.
Okay. I'm going to be a swine and put my foot down. Anil, I'll allow you to go, and then I think we should wrap up.
Thank you, Michaela. I just wanted to say that to his point, I think that's a good idea, and I'm sensitive to the statement that was made earlier that there was a feeling, at least by one of the participants, that they're able to address these issues without having to deal with a thicker, without having a need for a thicker who is. And I just wanted to say, whatever best practices or solutions we come up for this issue of hijacking, I think we have to approach it not from a narrow perspective, but more from a comprehensive approach. Because whatever solutions we come up with, the narrower we focus, the more likely that we're going to allow some type of a loophole or a hole that bad actors can use. So I think even despite the fact that some people might feel that they can deal with this issue without a thicker who is, I think it's important to include that on the table as part of a sort of a multi-tiered approach to addressing the problem.
Okay. Anybody want to come back quickly on that? Okay, from the deathly silence, I'll take that as a no. Anybody got any other comments or business they want to raise today? No? Okay. In that case, then we'll adjourn until next week. And I believe that a large portion of you probably are on other conference calls later today. So thanks, everybody, for your time and participation, and I'll probably speak to you later.
Thank you.
Thanks, McKaylee.
Thanks, McKaylee.
Thanks, Jenny.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.